While this is coming up, I'd like to introduce Eileen Allen, who's the president of the International Association of Forensic Nurses. And Eileen and I go back a lot of years. She is an international speaker on sexual assault and interpersonal violence. She's a graduate of Monmouth University, and she's faculty there. And she teaches forensic pathology as well as sexual assault evaluations across the lifespan. So I'm going to get to her presentation, and let's welcome Eileen Allen.
Good morning. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I thank Dr. Speck for including our organization in the presentation. I want to tell you a little bit about who we are and what we do, and talk with you about how we fit into the concept of promoting prevention on a number of levels. Our concept of forensic nursing is that we are the practice of nursing globally when health and legal systems intersect. People think forensic, and back in the old days I always talk about growing up thinking that it was all about dead bodies and death investigation. And you heard the term, and I used to see TV shows as a kid and think that that was it. And as I became involved in nursing practice and then began to recognize all of the places in which we provide care in situations where individuals have been involved in an act of interpersonal violence or catastrophic accident, and the result of that care that we provide may end up involved in the legal system in one way or another at some point in time, helped me to really truly understand what forensic nursing is all about. Basically, we evolved over a period of time, quarter century or more ago. In 74, the first forensic nurses identified as such in Canada worked in death investigation in Calgary, Alberta. There was a medical examiner by the name of John Butt, and he was the first physician that we are aware of who recognized the value of nursing process and brought these nurses in to assist in the investigation of deaths in his jurisdiction. At around the same time, and I like to really attribute it as an evolution from the women's movement of the late 60s and early 70s, we had nurses recognizing that the treatment of women involved in interpersonal violence, domestic violence, and sexual assault that was occurring in emergency departments was really not the most ideal, appropriate treatment for these patients in those situations. And as a result of that, we had nurses, independent of each other and unknown to each other, throughout the 70s, beginning to establish what became known as sexual assault examiner programs. But this was a recognition that we needed to look at the problem differently, we needed to look at the patient differently, and we needed to look at the process of providing care differently when we were dealing with victims of violence. In 1985, the U.S. Surgeon General identified violence as a public health issue, and that healthcare providers as key agents in ameliorating the effects of violence in our communities. We were already there. Nobody really knew we were there at the time, but we were already there. We were thinking this way. In 91, the American Nurses Association published a position paper stating that violence is a nursing practice issue. And at the same time in 91, a woman by the name of Virginia Lynch was doing research, and she published a thesis that conceptualized the forensic nurse while she was doing her graduate work at the University of Texas. In 92, the first group of nurses got together, and they formed the International Nursing Organization for Forensic Nurses while at a meeting hosted by Dr. Linda Ledre in Minneapolis, Minnesota. That Minneapolis is a hotbed of activity here. Canadian nurses became involved at that initial meeting, and that was the reason why we looked at a more global perspective. This was just not about U.S. care, treatment, policy, procedure. This was about looking at this all over the world. In 95, forensic nursing was officially recognized as a specialty of nursing practice in the United States by the ANA. And today, we have members as of our last scientific assembly, which just closed last week in Montreal, we have members in 27 countries. And they include countries around the world, Canada, Australia, Japan, you can see the list there. What do we do? Well, basically, our mission is to provide leadership in forensic nursing practice by developing, promoting, and disseminating information internationally about forensic nursing science. Our goals are clearly defined. And one of our most pointed goals is to incorporate primary prevention strategies into our work at every level. We want to establish and improve standards of evidence-based forensic nursing practice. We want to promote and encourage the exchange of ideas and transmission of developing knowledge. We want to establish standards for ethical conduct and create and facilitate educational opportunities. Now, people say this whole concept of forensic nursing, okay, we get it, you're bigger than just sexual assault, you're bigger than just dead bodies. What is it about? Basically, we look at forensic nursing as the application of science to public or legal proceedings so that the forensic aspects of healthcare are combined with that biopsychosocial education of the nurse in the scientific investigation and treatment of trauma or death. And we deal with both victims and perpetrators of abuse, violence, criminal activity, and traumatic accidents. When we talk about forensic nurses, people wonder where we work and what we do. Some of us are hospital-based. Many of us are in pre-hospital settings, clinics, and community settings. Some of us are working collaboratively in legal or investigative arenas and businesses. And there are many of us who work in educational institutions, or we are in industrial and correctional institutions as well. So forensic nursing really reaches out to the places where the incidents occur, the violence happens, and the services are being provided primarily to those patients. Some of the roles that most people, when we hear forensic nursing now, are familiar with are that of sexual assault examiner and death investigator. But forensic nurses also care for anyone who is involved in some type of violent interaction that results in either physical and or psychosocial trauma. That includes individuals who deal with child abuse, legal nurse consulting, psych nursing, correctional nursing, and the nurse coroner death investigator. The other thing that you need to be aware of is that forensic nurses truly look at our patients as not only the primary individual to whom we are providing acute healthcare services, but we look at to our patient population to include the family, because they are impacted by the violence, the friends, the social network, because they interact with these patients and often need guidance and assistance and support and referrals to the appropriate resources in the community. So nursing tends to take a much more holistic, global view of providing care to the patient. In order to be a full member of the International Association, you're required to be a registered nurse or the equivalent internationally. Professionals who are interested in or supporting forensic nursing practice can also sign on as associate members. We accept and encourage students to become involved in our organization. And when we talk about membership, benefit highlights include online access to the Journal of Forensic Nursing, numerous resources and networking opportunities, and multiple types of discounts on services and goods. As an organization, we have established a certification body. The Forensic Nursing Certification Board operates independently but under the umbrella of the International Association. And this certification board offers the opportunity to attain tangible recognition of professional achievement in a defined functional and clinical area of nursing practice. Our FNCB was established in 2002. And the opportunities for nationally recognized certification include the SANE, Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner of Adolescent and Adult Populations, and the SANE-P, Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner of Pediatric Populations. We also, in 2009, worked collaboratively with ANA to develop an advanced practice portfolio recognition process. The ANA is moving away from the development of additional certifications, per se, at the advanced level, but this portfolio recognition process is another mechanism for recognizing excellence and a professional standard beyond that of the average practitioner. We have a journal which is published quarterly. It is peer-reviewed, and it is dedicated to advancing the science of forensic nursing. It covers all facets of the multidisciplinary specialty, including healthcare, law enforcement, legal issues, and forensic science. So the articles that are published there are very well received within our interdisciplinary groups. We host a database of forensic programs across the world. If you want to know what's available, educational programs, offerings, you can come to our website and see what's out there. And many of those are interdisciplinary educational offerings. There are more than 500 programs currently listed. The IAFN, when we talk about our value proposition, we are a unique organization because we provide professionals in the fields of forensic nursing and prevention with opportunities for continuing education, proof of professionalism through certification, access to research, and networking. These are some of the other values that as an organization we have structured in our formal strategic plan. What we give to membership, and I think it's really important to recognize and to be able to clearly define as a professional organization what our members should be able to expect from us. And that includes effective communication, an increase in the science of forensic nursing through research and evidence, a focus on violence prevention, greater visibility and encouraged collaboration with other nursing organizations and legal systems. And let me say that one of my personal goals as president for 2011 was to truly look at this issue and how we could as an organization begin to collaborate more fully and more permanently with other organizations trying to do the same work, because as we heard earlier, there are many organizations out in the world today. We are sometimes competing for funds. We are sometimes doing the same types of work and expending manpower, funds, time and energy, trying to get things done. And if we could collaborate, if we could be more aware, if we could pool our resources, we might be so much better able to meet the needs of the populations that we're trying to serve. So IAFM this year established a collaborative relationship with the American Association of Legal Nurse Consultants to provide joint educational offerings for nurses working in this arena. In addition to that, we have almost finalized our first formal affiliation agreement with the Canadian Forensic Nurses Association. Seems like a natural fit for us, and we're working on the legal documentation right now. We've also, through Emergency Nurses Association membership at their conference, which is a very large conference, a member brought to the floor a resolution asking ENA to reach out to IAFN so that their organization and our organization would collaborate in order to provide education in those areas where we have intersections and overlap in interest, because much of what happens in an emergency department has a forensic nature to it. So that recognition was there, and it happened to be a member from my home state of New Jersey, so it was very exciting to hear the resolution had been passed resoundingly by the membership. And ENA has reached out to our board, and we are now working on developing some continuing education programs together. And also, we received a request from AVA to review the core competencies document, and as a board, we took that responsibility seriously. We looked at what our prior involvement with other organizations, publications, and issues, position statements had been, and we decided that we wanted to be recognized as a supporter of the good work being done by organizations who are like-minded and have like goals. So we signed on as an official supporter of the core competencies document this year as well. In addition, for our members, we talk about the increasing opportunities to network, to share ideas, and to communicate best practice. One of the concerns we have is that in nursing, we see our own scope of practice, we see our own direction, we see our own research, and yet we tend to have tunnel vision. We talk about the silos. People are sort of working in their own little world and not necessarily recognizing what else is going on in the world. So we want to network not only internally, but we want our members to have the opportunity to network externally. We've just revamped our website, and one of the future goals is to ensure that we link directly on our homepage or in some very prominent place with information from other organizations that will help our members to advance their own practice and to know about what best practice literature is available to them. This contact information needs to be updated officially as of today, November 1st, and I wasn't thinking when we put the slide up. We have gone to a virtual office. And this was a big step for us. We're a 3,000-plus member organization. We have 7 full-time staff, and we have additional contracted staff. And we made the decision in looking at the finances in the world that we live in that paying for the overhead of having a space was not necessarily best serving our membership. So we today are officially completely virtual. Our staff now live all over the United States and are working from home, meeting up. We've established a mechanism for them to communicate via different technologies. There's a lot of phone contact, there's a lot of computer contact, then there's voice and face contact through Skype and other types of services like that. And we're very excited about the idea that we're taking monies that were used to pay for the four walls and being able to redirect those. So as an organization, we feel we've done a number of different things to look at serving our membership and also to look at directing funding towards what our primary goals are, increasing the concepts of evidence-based practice and also looking at incorporating primary prevention. And I just wanted to make one more comment about the whole concept of prevention strategies. As an organization, we have grown over the past 19 years to be at a point where we are competitively applying for and seeking federal funding from a variety of agencies and organizations to work on projects like sustainability of forensic nursing programs around the country. We have great ideas. We've got people doing all kinds of wonderful things out in the field. But as the programs grow and evolve, we see that funding attention gets drawn to the latest, the greatest, the newest, and the brightest neon sign. And we want to make sure that these programs are there for perpetuity. How do we help them to survive? And we've gotten some federal grant funding to look at doing some good research in order to help us promote the sustainability of programs around the world. The other thing we're doing right now is we have funding for a distance learning initiative because we recognize the fact that these programs have grown up in places where we have large cities and great universities and people who understand the need for the services we provide. But we're also very aware that those in rural communities, those in areas that are not easily reached for purposes of services and training, are not being able to provide these services. So we've developed and will be launching in January of next year a distance learning program specifically geared for rural communities to get some basic education in forensic nursing and sexual assault examination. And we have 300 nurses being funded in the first round, and we will fund another 300 nurses to go through the program beginning in the summertime. So we'll have 600 additional nurses by the end of this year trained to provide this service to the greatest need in the rural communities. And those are the types of initiatives we're looking at. We feel that if we can reach out as a secondary prevention organization and intervene, we can then begin to identify populations and look at how we can step back and really move into the field of primary prevention.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Eileen.
I'd like to take this moment to introduce Roger Caniff. He's a graduate of the University of North Carolina Law School, and he's now the president of In Violence Against Women International. And I have a longstanding relationship with that organization also. It's tremendous. Roger, if you get a chance, look at his blog. It is fantastic what he writes. But what his real job is he's a prosecutor. And so we're starting to see the multidisciplinary and interprofessional relationships within the organizations that we're presenting today. He prosecutes a special victims unit, it's called, I guess, at your place, okay? Yeah, it's child abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, and other crimes that are interpersonal. So without further ado, Roger Caniff.
Thank you very much, Dr. Speck. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I definitely want to hear from you all, too, once I get through.
Come on up here.
Into
the mic.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Let me just bring my
Go ahead. Oh, yeah.
I am here representing In Violence Against Women International, and we do have some fairly sophisticated AD materials, and I am the idiot that didn't bring them, so I apologize for that. I've been under immense pressure at work, which of course we all have, so that's not much of an excuse, but I'm just coming off of a trial that lasted for a couple weeks and was just very draining on all of us, and it was just all I could do to get here and keep it together, but I am honored to be here. So I've got my computer to prompt me, so I go through the main points regarding EVOL, because it really is a wonderful organization. I'm going to begin with our mission statement, and then first things first, for those of you who are taking notes, please do Google us. We'd love to see you on our website. It is pretty well developed. It is evawintl.org. You can simply Google End Violence Against Women International. It will come right up. But we would love to see you there. Bottom line is, this is our mission: to change our response to sexual violence. EVAW International focuses on connecting professionals and strengthening the community's response system. We bring together the many diverse professionals who respond to victims of violence against women to communicate, share, learn, and ultimately to strengthen the whole system by better understanding each component. All this collaborative work is focused on creating a more compassionate response for the victim, a more aggressive prosecution of the perpetrator, and a more secure environment for communities everywhere. That is what EVAW is about. That's what we strive to do. Probably the main thing that gives us substance and makes us unique is that we have a multidisciplinary board, which is unusual in this business, and it really is a wonderful strength for us. End Violence Against Women International is made up of, primarily, its beating heart is really the executive director, a woman named Joanne Archambault, who's just a wonderful human being. She is a retired San Diego police officer. She was a San Diego cop for about 25 years. The bulk of her career was in investigating sexual assaults, quite a bit of child abuse as well. She retired from the San Diego Police Department and began doing consulting work on her own with a company called SATI, S-A-T-I, which is basically Sex Assault Training Institute. She is probably the foremost law enforcement trainer with regard to sexual assault in the United States. About eight years ago, Joanne and a group of visionaries founded End Violence Against Women, and the idea was to create an organization to deal with the primary and the secondary response, primarily to violence against women, with a board of directors that drew from several different disciplines and several different areas of expertise. There isn't a thing wrong with organizations and boards that deal primarily from one area of expertise, whether it's advocacy or medicine or law enforcement or what have you. Those organizations are fantastic and they are very valuable. But EVAW was a bit of an experiment, and part of what the founding directors, I'm actually not a founding director, I was sort of second generation, but what the founding directors wanted to do is a little bit of an experiment with regard to, well, what kind of a collaborative effort could we get together if we develop a board that brings together individuals from the various disciplines? As many of you probably know, in most places, the response to violence against women and children, and men as well, the response to sexual violence, it's often kind of a four-legged stool. It often involves law enforcement, a medical response, the response of victim advocates, and those associated with advocacy and like victim witness liaisons and folks such as that, and then finally prosecution. So that 1, 2, 3, 4 is kind of how the response is set up in most communities. And it is really key for those four disciplines to work together. Traditionally, they have not worked together very well. They've all sort of been their own offshoots. That's kind of how it was set up around the turn of the last century. But thankfully, and I know Eileen mentioned this a little while ago, The victims and women's movements of the 70s and 80s really drove forward the idea, you know, IAFN that Eileen talked about, an organization that I greatly admire, they came out of the idea that forensic nurses were necessary to provide a better response to victims of sexual violence and other forms of violence. In the same vein, and because of the same visionaries and the same pioneers, that's the kind of thing that eventually gave birth to the team concept to fight sexual violence primarily, but also domestic violence, family violence, and violence against children. So that's kind of what EVA is about. So our board of directors consists of individuals from definitely those four areas, and in addition to a couple of other things as well. We have at least two, maybe three lawyers, that's probably two too many, including myself. We have a couple of sex assault nurse examiners. We have a medical doctor. We have several victim advocates. We have a couple of individuals who specialize in violence and victimization of those with disabilities, and just basically several other disciplines that we draw from. It's a really vibrant, interesting board, and we've really come a long way in the past few years. We're definitely still in the throes of growing pains. We have still have a lot of work to be done. Our biggest effort every year is an international conference that we host on domestic violence, stalking, sexual violence, and things of that nature. We are not as child abuse focused as other organizations. I do a lot of child abuse work personally. I've prosecuted quite a bit of child abuse in my career, but EVAWI is primarily focused on the adult side of things. We meet once a year in different cities. We've got our cities all planned out through like 2015, I think, at this point, if not even further. We usually assemble, I think we started out with around 300 to 400 people, and we're up to around 1,000 people now per year who come out, much like, you know, it's not as big as this conference, but similar to this conference in that we split off. There's several different tracks. There's some great keynotes and things of that nature. So that's our primary effort in terms of getting everybody together. Our other efforts include expert consultation. We will actually provide technical assistance to individuals who are out dealing with sexual violence in their community from however it's coming to them. If they are in prosecution, if they are an advocate who is seeking assistance, if they're a medical person who's looking to, you know, who's looking for, you know, to connect with others in order to form a program, things of that nature, we can provide help there. We provide original training materials because one of the real gems of EVA is our research staff. We actually have a PhD, Dr. Kim Lonsway, who's just a fantastic dynamo of a person, and additional staff members who assist. And part of what they do is actually form and create real research, cutting-edge research with regard to issues that concern violence against women. One of the biggest ones, particularly when it comes to sexual assault, is the issue of how police, primarily law enforcement associations, categorize rape and sexual violence and sexual assault, and how they define things like false or baseless or unprosecutable or things of that nature. One of the toughest myths that we deal with in the business of violence against women, particularly when it comes to sexual assault, one of the toughest myths that we deal with is the idea that women regularly or often lie about being sexually violated. And we train on this. I train on this all over the country. I've trained on it now all over the world. And wherever I go, I always get the same thing. When I tell people, you know, there is no reason to believe, you know, can a woman lie about being sexually assaulted? Of course she can. Does that happen? Of course it does. Can a man lie about being sexually assaulted? Of course he can. Does it happen? Of course it does. Does it happen with some sort of regularity that's higher or different from other sorts of crimes? No, absolutely not. Same thing with children. Do children lie about being sexually violated? Yes, they do. Does it happen often? No, it doesn't. Is there any research to suggest otherwise? Absolutely not. And yet that is one of the most stubborn myths out there that continues to persist no matter how hard we try to knock it down. And one of the ways that we've tried to do that is to say, you know what, let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's do real research, real strict methodological research on the prevalence of, for instance, false reporting in terms of sexual violence. You'll have no problem finding quote-unquote studies that demonstrate or purport to demonstrate that there are high rates of false reporting when it comes to sexual assault. If you take even the most cursory look at those studies, you will find that they are remarkably flawed. And yet they are touted by men's rights groups and by, you know, various web pages, sometimes even defense attorneys sponsor web pages that talk about how often women lie about being raped, and therefore if you find yourself in that situation, young man, you need to call, you know, so-and-so and son's attorneys, blah, blah, blah. And they'll quote this quote-unquote research all over the place. But if you take a close look at it, which is what organizations like ours have done, and in particular us, you'll find that those studies are extremely flawed, that the methods they use don't make any sense, and that they really don't tell us anything of substance. End Violence Against Women, in collaboration with some other organizations, has since conducted its own research through a project called MAD, Making a Difference. And the MAD project did close, methodological, strict examinations of various police departments around the country and internationally to determine, all right, well, what are actual rates of false reporting? For instance, if a police department has a case involving, let's say, a prostitute who reports being sexually assaulted. Prostitutes are raped. It's happening right now as we speak. As I think we all know, prostitutes are sexually assaulted at alarming rates, and they almost never report. But if one does, or an individual who's homeless reports a sexual assault, and they don't show up for a follow-up interview with the detective, the police department, in many cases, was very like, right, they'll drop it, and then they'll also classify it as false. Well, why did you think that was a false report? Well, because she never came in again. Where does she live? Under a bridge. Okay. Do you think you might have an issue with regard to serving this individual? Is there a reason to classify that as false other than she didn't follow up with whatever it was that you needed her to do because she is doing whatever she needs to do to survive? So it's things of that nature. And the researchers who have dug into this issue from our standpoint have discovered there are quite a bit of, how do I put this? Well, I guess I should just say inaccurate reporting of cases is false. These are actually not false reports. They are probably valid reports. There's no reason to believe that they're not valid, except that the individual involved either didn't participate with the investigation or the investigators themselves approached the case in such a flawed manner that there was just no getting to the truth of it. That's where, you know, particularly Joanne comes into play because she's just so fantastic at this and she's so dynamic. As a former police officer, as somebody who spent her entire career in law enforcement, Joanne is very good at training police officers because they're generally the first responders. They're usually where the rubber meets the road in terms of the first official, the first person in authority that an individual reports sexual violence to. And their response is so important. You all may or may not know this, some of you probably do. The most important aspect, the greatest variable that determines how deeply and how quickly an individual will heal if they've been sexually violated is the response that they receive from the various people that they dare to tell it to. And most sexual violence is never reported. And this is something I have to knock into the heads of prosecutors that I teach and cops and everybody's, you know. And when I teach young DAs especially, and I consult now for the military, and I tell them, you know, you'll get these cases that'll cross your desk and you'll say, oh, well, this involves alcohol and this looks like kind of a gray situation and who knows really what happened here and why do I always get these cases? And I always tell them, you know, you assume that everybody who is sexually assaulted reports it. It's like almost nobody does. I mean, it's in the teens, perhaps, for percentage by most surveys in terms of men and women who actually come forward, and men definitely underreport, but women underreport as well because they know what they're getting into most of the time. They know through popular culture. They know through the experience of others. They know that it is a miserable process. They generally know that the chances of their attacker actually facing some sort of consequences for it are almost nil, and they almost never report. The ones that do dare to come forward get a response that is incredibly varied in terms of its competence, in terms of its confidence, and in terms of its compassion. And EVOS strives to, again, sort of tighten up that four-legged stool so that the response is coordinated and the response is compassionate, which is why we're grateful to organizations like IAFM because they are, you know, they're developing standards and they are enhancing the professionalism of the medical professionals who respond to sexual violence, which is a key component of what we do. We are trying to, you know, when we have a couple of medical folks on our board, two or three actually, that work with IAFN and where, you know, we sort of work together and are kind of moving forward on the same track, hopefully. In addition, the police training, Joanne continues to do quite a bit. We love to see police officers at our conference, and thankfully we're seeing more and more of them. primarily our conferences were made up of advocates, at least at first. Advocates are wonderful. They play an absolutely fantastic role. They advocate on behalf of the victim. They stand between the victim and the rest of the world. They make sure that the victim understands her rights. They make sure that she's not abused by the system. And that's fantastic. But in a sense, it's been preaching to the choir for a few years. And, you know, it's wonderful to have advocates there, and that's important. We need to pump them up. We need to get them together. We need them to be strengthened by, you know, the bonding that occurs at these conferences. But we know that we need to expand, and that's the greatest thing that we've been doing is we've been expanding. We're getting more and more detectives at our conferences, more and more patrol officers, more and more prosecutors, and that's really what we want, because we want everybody to be clicking on all cylinders. That's really how we get to the bottom of this, and that is what we seek to do. I think that pretty much covers the basics of it. Oh, one other thing I want to talk about. We have a campaign that we started a few months ago, which is something that we're really, really excited about. This, too, I would urge you to pick it up and Google it if you can. It's called Start By Believing, SBB. startbybelieving.org. It's an offshoot of EVA. You can find the campaign through our website as well, but I would definitely invite you to check it out. Start By Believing aims to improve that response even one step back. Because remember, what I was saying was the response to sexual, you know, the major variable that influences how people heal when they're sexually violated is the response that they receive from the people they dare to tell. Unfortunately for us, those of us on the team, whether we're in prosecution, forensic medicine, advocacy, or law enforcement, oftentimes by the time we get the complaint, that person has already opened up to a friend or a lover or a resident advisor if they're in college or a neighbor or a coworker or somebody else, and they have received a very, very negative response. Start By Believing aims to improve the response not only by the authorities. Those folks we can train, at least. We can go to the International Association of Chiefs of Police. We can go to IAFN. They come to us. We can go to various police departments out there. We can go to colleges and universities, and we can beg them, please train, teach compassion. You don't have to accept every single thing every single person says at face value. It's very, very common, as a matter of fact, that victims of sexual violence will either withhold the truth or lie about small peripheral details, because tragically they feel that if they're completely truthful, well, I was drinking and I was wearing a short skirt, they think they're going to hurt their case or they're going to be ashamed or whatever, so they hide those details from us, and that's the worst thing they can do. But the core allegation itself is usually correct, and there's usually no reason to doubt it. So what Start By Believing aims to do is to tell people, simply start by believing. If somebody tells you that, you know, they believe they have cancer, are you going to look at them cockeyed and say, well, how do you know? And is that really true? And what did you do to get it? And, you know, things of that nature. We're usually not that cruel or heartless when it comes to those kinds of circumstances, even though there are behaviors that we can get into that cause us harm in some ways. But when it comes to sexual violence, there is still a tremendous amount of judgment that is heaped upon the victims of it because of the perceived imperfections they have or the actions they took or did not take. And it really is tragic. I have a friend and colleague named Teresa Scalza, who's way above me. She's probably the foremost sort of DA figure in this whole thing. She's a real pioneer. And she and I talk about this all the time, you know, sexual violence against adults, against adult men and women, is really kind of the last frontier in terms of developing a reservoir of sympathy. You can, you know, you can definitely get people excited and angry, rightfully so, about child abuse, and they should be excited and angry about it. And child abuse is a horrific phenomenon that has, as we saw, and that was a wonderful diagram, Doctor. The Koliva, I believe you call it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. The sequelae of that violence against children is remarkable, and of course against adults as well. You can also get people excited about domestic violence. They will generally feel sympathy toward a battered spouse, you know, particularly battered women, or battered children, even pets. But when it comes to the sexual victimization of adults, where usually alcohol is involved, usually some perceived weaknesses or quote-unquote bad behaviors are involved, it is very, very difficult to get people to feel sympathy toward those victims. Even when people believe that they actually were victimized, they still want to stand back, distance themselves from that victimization, and throw a lot of judgment at that individual. And Start By Believing aims to quell that and to say, listen, first of all, this happens to a remarkable amount of people. And when we start talking and we get together, we realize it's true. When we start talking and we get together, when we realize how many people have been sexually victimized, they just never share their stories with others. And when we can also convince them that chances are the core allegation is also true. So start by believing. Again, if it turns out to be something that you didn't think it was, so be it. That won't happen very often, but of course it will happen. But there's a virtue in beginning by believing and supporting. And the virtue is that the victimized person will heal much quickly and much more efficiently and much more completely. So that covers the basics of it. I'm going to turn it back over to Dr. Speck now, and I thank you all very much for listening.
Thank you very much. Okay, this is our time to ask these leaders questions, and I'm going to start it off because having been president of IFN and now I'm chair of the Family Violence Forum here at the APHA, one of the things I know is that sustaining organizations is difficult and planning for future is difficult to bring to consensus. So my question to the panel, and anyone and everyone can answer, is what types of barriers have your organizations faced as you try to meet your mission? And anyone can start.
I think it appears that we may be the most mature of the organizations represented here tonight as far as stage of development. We just had our 19th scientific assembly, so we're sort of in our adolescence as far as organizational development goes. And I think one of the primary barriers that we've faced is being able to recognize that for one reason or another, you have the draw to bring in groups with a particular focus or interest. It may be the child abuse people, or it may be, in our case, the vast majority of our membership started off as sexual assault in our case. And when we look at the family violence prevention organization here and the forum that's being developed and expanding, I think one of the things that we had to deal with was the constant struggle between limited resources and the desire of the majority of the population to focus on a particular topic or subject area or move in a certain direction, and yet the recognition as leaders within the organization that we wanted to keep a broad scope. We wanted to be able to provide membership value to as many people who had common interests, and to be able to then as an organization educate and bring out the commonality amongst individuals and interesting concerns that seem to be to some degree divergent. So keeping that big picture and being able to meet the needs of many of the people so that we can keep them engaged, involved, and participating so that we can continue to grow the organization. That's one of the issues that I feel we've begun to deal with more adequately over the past few years. Mm-hmm.
So for us, the challenge is really, I mean, if you think about it, you know, we've completed our first 5 years. I think we've really mm-hmm. made some very significant advances. The challenges that we have are getting the word out. We know the community is rather large. If you just look at the number of people that are involved in these three organizations, our community is very large. And what we need to do is really to come together. And the collaborations is one way. But to grow this organization, the Academy on Violence and Abuse, because we have indeed want the leaders of academics, interprofessionals, that is indeed the direction that we want, but we also want everybody else to participate in the development of that. So we're not excluding anybody. We want anybody who's a health professional to really participate. We are not an advocacy. We really don't want to be an advocacy organization. There have been, you know, many wonderful advocacy organizations. So we want to keep that health focus, that health connection. So we do understand it takes time. We do understand that it takes resources. We have wonderful, committed membership. We have wonderful board members. We have wonderful staff. We also did go virtual just about a couple of weeks ago. And the whole idea now is to use the technology that's available to communicate and, again, to redirect the resources instead of putting it into personnel to put it in four walls, to put it towards the programs and to get the word out. So well, we know what our challenges are, and we welcome you, and we want to, you know, to be a together journey, because that's the way we look at it. It is a journey. We are in this together, and the more we work together, the better an organization that we all of us will have.
Mm-hmm. Roger?
Yeah, I would say, I guess for us, it's similar getting the word out. One thing that we're really seeking is we're really seeking some corporate sponsorship, particularly with the Start by Believing campaign, just because, you know, just frankly, just because of the resources involved. It's a tough time. You know, money is always an issue. We're going into a fourth year of a bruising recession. It's just a very, very tough time. And we are hoping that the leap we're trying to take is to get some good, well-heeled corporate sponsorship behind the Start by Believing campaign. And the challenge there is what I talked about before. It's, you know, when we talk to people about it, and they're like, well, is this about kids? Is it about DV? No, it's about sexual assault. And we still get sort of the blank stare. It's like, well, are we talking about date rape? I mean, are we talking about rape? Are we talking about... And they really, you know, they're well-intentioned people. They're not looking to be insensitive or offensive or anything like that. But unfortunately, that kind of thinking still persists. You know, if someone isn't grabbed and thrown behind the bushes and raped at knife point, then they haven't been really, quote-unquote, sexually assaulted. So that's, I think, that barrier of understanding, which then creates a barrier to resources that we need, are probably the hardest part for us.
I think that's an excellent response. If we think about it, they've identified finances, silos, growth, including breaking down the silos. And so I would be remiss if I did not tell you that the Family Violence Forum is all about breaking down silos also. So if you have not signed up, please do. There's a brochure here also. I'd like to open it up to questions. All right, I have three. Let's start in the back.
In your line with your breaking down silos, I'd like to know how you interface with both federal and state government agencies, particularly those within HHS and federal level, like HRSA and ACF, that deal with the populations you're speaking about, either sharing resources with them, giving them resources, particularly with all the programs that are being developed now for early childhood. I would love to know you guys, programs that work to integrate into programs that are now being federally funded in our community, and getting resources back from them for you guys.
I can tell you that as our organization has reached this point of adolescence, one of the things we recognized was that we grew our membership to a point of over 3,000. We'd like to continue to grow our membership, but we really wanted to focus on being asked at the table, being in the presence of the decision makers, being recognized as an authority in the area with the knowledge and the resources to give something and bring something to the table. And to that end, we as an organization have signed on as a lobbying firm. And we did a lot of research because this is not an inexpensive proposition. And again, we're all dealing with a finite amount of resources. But what we did was initially find an organization, a lobbying organization, that represents other like-minded groups and agencies, so that they understood without a lot of training and education what we were thinking about, what our issues were, where we needed to focus. And they've begun to educate us. They're not actively lobbying for us. We do not have a PAC. We are not going to be. We're Political Action Committee. But what we are going to do is utilize what this firm can bring to us as far as teaching us how to interact, as far as helping us to identify and weed through. We are a volunteer organization for the most part. We, as I said, we have a staff of 7 for 3,000 plus members internationally, and we have limited time to go through all of the mountains of information and literature out there to figure out where we need to be focusing our attention. So that's what we're using our dollars for, is to have somebody who's here in Washington, who's keeping an ear to the ground, who's knowing which meetings are going on and which places there might be an invitation for an organization like ours to voice our concern and to offer our resources. And we are very, very excited about the level of effectiveness that's had in only the 6 months we've been working in this direction. So that's something to consider.
That's me.
I think the way we are doing it is with a collaboration of the organization that I talked to you about, NACO, the National Health Collaborative on Violence and Abuse. So, you know, if you look traditionally how the fields develop, child abuse, you know, in the 70s, intimate partner violence, you know, a little bit later, elder abuse is what's known as the orphan that nobody wants to look at, right? So if you look at all of those, how do we try to integrate them? Because the government agencies also think in silos, right? Absolutely. And the way to do that is at the policy level. We don't call it lobbying. We call it education. I was calling it lobbying, and they corrected me. So it's about education. So when we go and do our briefings with NACO, we did the briefing that I did in April at the Congress. We go to the Hill. We talk to the lawmakers, because lawmakers are the ones that fund the government agencies. And when they begin to see that we actually are changing our language, because that's actually what we're doing when you talk about violence and abuse, we're just not talking about child abuse now, or sexual assault, or, you know, that. So that our language is more inclusive, understanding that social ecology model, taking that, taking the psychosocial approach. These are the key concepts. When we start talking about it this way, then they begin to think about it. Like I said, the American AAMC was a medical college, but now they have this interprofessional group. And if you look at healthcare and the way it's going the next 5 years, it's going to be teams. It's no longer going to be that one intern taking care of that patient at night. It's going to be a team. That's where health education is going. That's where healthcare reform is going. So people are beginning to understand that to do the best patient care, that we all have to get and work in teams. Government will get it, but we are on our way, because now we see when we interact with HRSA, AVA does not personally interact with HRSA. But we have a grant from ARC. The two conferences were funded by ARC. And what is really exciting is, because they've been funding the funds, futures conferences all these years, and they are more towards IPV, or domestic violence, and they said they wanted to really give us this grant because we are across the lifespan. And it's not going to be easy, because its tradition is history.
That's
and
right.
Across those silos, you know, is not easy at all. But that's why we're very, very excited to have Bob Block, you know, who actually is one of the silo people. You see his evolution occurring right before your eyes, because he was a silo guy. He's a pediatrician. He's responsible for having this new subspecialty, child abuse pediatrics. And here he is now, leader of American Academy of Pediatrics, and putting in the language about that it has to be in context of the violence that's going on in the family.
Right.
Why I got into this as a pediatrician, that's all I knew. Take care of the children who had the effects of turned them to law officers, turned them to social workers, and on I went. It's really no understanding of the family dynamics.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Roger?
Ours is primarily through OVW, primarily through the Office of Violence Against Women. That's our primary window into the federal system.
Okay. Yes, I have one in the back there. Just a minute, bye.
Hi, Rachel Wong from Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm new to this field, so I follow the consulting with Joyful Heart Foundation, so I apologize if my questions are basic. My background is in hospice and palliative care and organ donation. And as you were talking about breaking down cultural judgment and also crossing silos and then creating collaboration, I wonder if you've reached out to other fields, such as hospice end of life care, organ donation, to see what folks have done there. And I know you're so far ahead in bringing these issues to the dinner table, but as you're talking about, you know, issues like that, have you reached out to other fields to see what they have done to mass media or social media?
Roger. We are constantly on the lookout.
Yeah, yeah.
Constantly, because we want to learn from movements that have come before us. If you think about humanity, we are relatively young, really, in 3 or 4 decades of work here. Mm-hmm. So in that, if you look at it in that historical perspective, a lot has been achieved. Mm-hmm. We have really come. I mean, start by believing it's happening, but now, at least the young people, when you talk to them, those barriers are far less. They seem to just get it so easily and understand it. So I think the internet is really, really a wonderful way by which we get the word out, by which we share knowledge. Young people are just so open-minded and accepting of these ideas. We don't have as many myths within them. But again, when the young college students get, know that if they have a sexual assault or a rape that they can go and access, it doesn't happen. There's a lot of work that needs to be done at college campuses. But again, there's a lot of work.
True.
Yes.
And interestingly enough, the International Association has embraced and adopted the transplant nurses into our organization because of the recognition of the fact that many of the patients and families that they work with come to the point of being transplant donors because of violence or catastrophic accident.
That's
so
right.
That we see them as part of that forensic whole, mm-hmm. and we bring their knowledge, their experience, their perspective, and their vision into working within our big focus in the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Michael?
I start with the word authority and responsibility. Authority implies ownership and control. Responsibility puts the onus on the person. You can delegate authority, you cannot delegate responsibility. And there's power and money can kill anything. and does. I mean, Greece, Rome, and maybe this country too. I think of other people to pull into this, whatever this structure is. By the way, excuse my camera, but I'm thinking back with your photographs, this is a historic event. I can see Washington, Jefferson, and Madison. I would add, the people I would think to add, besides ourselves, of course, the World Health Organization, National Association of Conference of Children, National District Attorneys Association, American Bar Association, National Association of Medical Examiners, IFSCAN, ILFR, and there's a bunch of people. If you think in terms of authority, then you can kill that real fast, but who's
right.
The head? If you think in responsibility, it just sounds like a lot of work, and then you at least cut down some of that stuff. If we were going to... I'm asking Memphis, our expert on something, for doing this thing. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
What would you see? What might this thing look like in a year, in 5 years?
Well, if the Family Violence Forum is successful with the permission they gained at their meeting to become a caucus, then the relationships that can develop between organizations such as the ones you're seeing today can... And by virtue of the volume of organizations that you named, because invitations will go to all of them, to be active participants at our round table. While we become a caucus, create strategies that will impact healthcare delivery at the primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention levels. We all have our little niche, but collectively, the vision is that we can actually have violence become a primary issue to the American Public Health Association. And the reason we want to do that is because, just as I said on the opening session, as much as half of the world's population will be affected by violence. And that's the ones we know about. The ones we do not know about are the 2 minutes, okay. The ones we do not know about are those individuals who have been impacted by violence and, as Roger said, have never been brave enough to come forward. So the vision then is to bring organizations together, to break down silos, to work on common goals, and that's what the caucus will be, the Family Violence Caucus. I have a question back here. Yes.
Hi, my name is Lillian Abegwe. I'm a doctoral student at the University of North Texas Health Science Center, and I have a couple of questions for Eva. When you listed the people you work with, like experts, technicians, I didn't hear you list students, and I was wondering if that's something that the organization can do or will do. My research interest is in domestic violence, and I found out that I'm in my second year, and my first year I go to classes, and even talking with my professors, everybody's like, okay, we understand it, but I don't know that they're fully aware about the work that needs to be done in the field. Mm-hmm. And taking the fact that the domestic violence organization in the football area has really been taken aback, you know, so I was wondering, I know that as a student, we will find you if we're interested in working in the domestic violence field, but is it also possible for the organizations to also reach out? Because you said something about some faulty research that's out there, mm-hmm. you know, and we as the students have the potential to set the record straight.
Sure.
So if there's some sort of relationship with the schools, you know, so that once we come in, you know, now my colleagues are a little bit aware about that, but it took me to, you know, go into all my classes and do all this work. But, you know, sometimes you can have it as one of the things that the organizations do up front is to, you know, liaise with schools so that we can encourage students to take the interest in that. That's one end. And before I go to speak on the second thing, now start by believing. I believe that it indirectly addresses what I want to say, but I was wondering about a more direct approach, because you talk about the fact that it's very difficult to get people to believe people who come out and speak. And looking at the case of domestic violence, that's even in the case of people who are physically abused. But psychological abuse is just a strong wall out there.
Even though the Center of Disease and Control says that
psychological abuse is one of the form of intimate partner violence, you don't get them. I'm a domestic abuse survivor, and I know that everywhere I went, because I was a victim of psychological abuse, they always asked me for a police report. And once I didn't have a police report, it was like they have my story.
Right.
You know, so you talked about an international conference, a national conference now that is growing in size, you know, and you have set up. I was also wondering about, you know, pushing, even for the caucus, you know, pushing psychological abuse recognition also. So not even just the starting by belief for physical violence, but even for psychological abuse, where it's all, you just have to believe my story.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't know what.
Sure. Yeah, I would say to answer your first question, I would definitely encourage you to reach out to Dr. Lonsway. She is a college professor herself. I'll find you when we're done here, and I'll make sure you can find her through our website. She's very accessible and wonderful, and she can tell you what the opportunities are between HIPAA and the schools, because that's a very good question. And your second point is very well taken. And Start by Believing is primarily focused on sexual violence. But I know that even on our board, we've talked about it. I think once we're taking baby steps, but we need to expand in the area that you're talking about. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question over here. Peggy?
Mine was going a little towards Michael's point.
Okay.
I agree. The word authority creates a challenge. Mm-hmm. The whole point of, I think, what we're trying to do here today at the meeting and with the forum mm-hmm. is the collaboration and co-ownership.
Absolutely.
authority tends to imply a hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Someone is in charge and therefore the others will follow,
mm-hmm.
in perhaps some subservient role. And the important thing
right.
is, again, having everybody at the table, everybody
right. at the round table.
At the round table, collaborating, nobody sitting at the head of the table
Correct.
Telling everybody else what to do, the authoritarian
uh-huh.
model, but everybody sitting across from each other, talking
sure.
to each other, and sharing the information with each other, regardless
sure.
of their where they're coming from with their expertise, but recognizing that the others also do have the expertise
mm-hmm.
to address this problem, even though they're coming from a different perspective.
And I think one of the groups that we have difficulty in inviting to the table are those who are actually victimized, so that they give a story. They are the stakeholder. They are the reason we are in the business we're in. And so when we don't have that stakeholder voice, it's very difficult for us to move forward. So I welcome that. And you had a question. Yes,
yeah,
ma'am.
My specific interest is in the healthcare response to domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, when I read that literature, I get always confused. And it seems like there's always this focus on two policies, routine screening of women and
mm-hmm.
Mandatory reporting, but in your experience, what are other policies that healthcare professionals can try to pass or
mm.
that are important in preventing violence and in intervening in the cycle of violence?
Well, we want it to be patient-centered, right? So it's not just about the health practitioners understanding the legal responsibilities that they have for the mandatory reporting, or just a screening questionnaire being imposed upon them. So we know that the compassionate healthcare professionals who do ask about violence in the patient's lives have developed a connection which is much deeper with the patients. So that is the model that we want all healthcare professionals to develop, is that have the compassion, have the knowledge about the violence, all the forms of violence, whether it's emotional, psychological, sexual, physical. So really that is what we at the Academy on Violence and Abuse are all about. We
mm-hmm.
want the healthcare practitioners to understand that you've got to move beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they don't know what is the differential diagnosis in a chronic pain patient, they never ask about the violence.
So what's the differential diagnosis?
Whenever you have, like you go to a healthcare practitioner and you have a headache, for example, then the doctor or the nurse or practitioner has to go through what the possibilities may be that's where the headache is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a sinus infection, it could be chronic stress, or it could be brain tumor, but you
mm-hmm.
see, all the time you think about brain tumor, that's a very, very, you know,
right.
uncommon reason for a headache. More commonly, it is the stress that person is going through by living in an environment of violence. But that common thing is not asked for. But the MRI is done for that very small percentage of the brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So that is.
Exactly.
And you know, it's interesting because the nursing model, differing from the medical model of differential diagnosis, the nursing model is holistic in approach and is founded in education and empowerment, because in order to have patients relay to us what truly is going on in their lives that may have an impact on this particular interaction, healthcare interaction, they need to understand that we are open to hearing what they have to say. They need to understand that we are educated to know what can be done when they do
mm-hmm.
share with us. And we need to be educated to empower our patients, to instill a level of trust in the interaction between the healthcare provider and the patient. So we work towards that holistic model of nurse-patient interaction, healthcare provider-patient interaction, and we are willing to share it throughout the healthcare community as well.
But
not just about the broken leg. It's about the incident that surrounded the causation of the person falling and so, you know, like, what was that about?
So, would that be like the policy? I'm just like thinking of the policy perspective. Like, you know, if you want to try to pass a law You know, I know that they've tried to pass laws for mandatory reporting, they've tried to pass laws for mandatory screening. What kind of laws do you think should be passed?
Well, the screening that, you know, which is right now, if it, the Affordable Health Care Act does go through, then all healthcare practitioners would have to ask about domestic violence.
Oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. That's part of Secretary Sebelius. The last Institute of Medicine report that came out has recommendations for screening, but it has not only for domestic violence screening,
right,
but also for HIV, there are eight different screenings. But if you think every one of them is a high risk for domestic violence, HPV, HIV, all of those things. So when you put this, you see, the AAMC that I talked about is slow to change, okay? But when you do this kind of policy work, and there are, you know, in California, we've had a screening law since 1994. And that nobody screens.
Right.
So it has to come from the, you know, from HHS, from Health and Human Services, right? When the leaders like Secretary Sebelius talks about it, this is a very, very exciting piece for us. This is a very important piece, because then what happens when you have something like this? Okay, so now where is the curriculum? How do you screen? What do you do with the patients? Government has not put money into that.
That's right.
We have never had the grants for doing the research. What is the best way to ask? What is the best intervention? What is the follow-up? We need research in all of those.
Right.
And it starts all of that going there.
And I'd like to...
I think that's important, because I was in the hospital like 2 weeks, I mean, sorry, 2 months ago, and the nurse was checking me and she said, are you a victim of domestic violence?
Yes.
Now, I have a 3-year-old, so I've been in and out of the hospital a lot in recent times. And so I was really very excited, because that's the first time I was hearing it, you know, so I was like, no, because I'd already left my situation. But I asked her, you know, why did you ask that person? She said, oh, you know, is that something we're required to do? And I was so degraded.
Yes.
She wasn't looking at me. You see, you know, I mean, I could be lying for all,
yes,
you know,
right,
but she was just going to check it out, you know, she had done her screening. And I just, I mean, it's good that we have the policy that they can ask the questions now, but I think we also need to get to the next stage where they understand that you can be lying about your answer. Just because the accuser is not there doesn't mean you're still not afraid.
Right.
And you won't disclose. And, you know, and not just to tell me it was just something I was required to do.
Right.
That wouldn't encourage anybody to.
I agree.
But it's called a dance of disclosure. That's also in the literature.
Exactly.
Some of the work that Barbara Gerbert has done at UCSF is that you have to have the trust in the providers that they understand the dynamics.
Right.
I have never had a problem, either within practice or outside of practice, or in the hallway, or in a social event, anybody disclosing to me and telling me, it takes less than 3 seconds, and they say, this is the first time that I've disclosed to you.
Yes.
This is the life I have led.
Right. I think this is a wonderful conversation. I'd like to thank our speakers. If you have other questions for them, we're going to have a short photo op over by there. But then after that, I'll be glad to release the masses to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.